So our service this morning is led by Reverend Matt Aspen and is titled Unbecoming. Most of us greet the new year with intentions to change one pattern or another in ourselves or in the world that we wish was different. But we are often reminded that just how strongly many of these things are wedded to our current ways of being. He will examine why change can sometimes be so hard and consider gentle strategies to help new ways of being emerge. This relates to our fourth principle, the search for truth and meaning.
Good morning, everyone. I am the Reverend Matt Aspen. I use he, him pronouns, and it is wonderful, as always, to be here with you today. First words of my sermon this week are very important. They go, whatever, 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 blah, blah, blah. One of the teenagers in my life shared a major challenge they were having in their writing class. They said that they were faced with when faced with a blank page, no matter how hard they tried, nothing came. So me, being the wise old sage that I am, eagerly dispensed the classic wisdom that all writers are offered at some point in their lives. If you find you can't write, the cure is you just have to sit down and start writing. Just get some words on a page, like whatever, 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 blah, blah, blah. And then more words will come, or so goes the saying. That's the process you can use to overcome that giant gorilla that wants to hold you down and won't let you lift your arms to open your laptop. And even when you then grabs your hand and points the cursor towards Solitaire or Candy Crush and what anywhere, anything other than Microsoft Word. Having then listened to this teenager rattle off about 27 very specific reasons why this would never work for them, how they were different, and how very hopeless the situation most clearly was, I quickly realized that my shared wisdom, as sage as it may have been, was not yet ready to be received by this particular teenager in this particular moment. Teenagers just don't seem to want to listen to our most important lessons sometimes. So, after spending the last 2 weeks procrastinating and writing this sermon, I finally quieted down my own inner teenager, sat down at the keyboard, and began writing, which is why the first line of today's sermon was, whatever, 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 blah, blah, blah. Today is January 9th, a little over a week after the calendar most of us in this country used to randomly mark the passage of time told us that we were beginning our next journey around the sun. The beginning of a new year is often a time of reflection on the events that occurred in the sliver of time that has just passed, and appearing ahead at a new calendar, pregnant with the unlimited possibility of our hopes and dreams and cherished wishes of brighter days ahead, which we can most assuredly expect. If only we could, that one thing, that one pesky thing about ourselves, that if we can only change that, we might be able to get to this time next year feeling truly happy and fulfilled. And thus was born the New Year's resolution. I suspect that there are at least three different types of folks listening to my words today. The first type of person is the one that sets New Year's resolutions every single year and achieves them. You go. The second type of person creates resolutions every year and very rarely achieves them, but they keep trying year after year, hopeful that this is going to be the year that they're able to buckle down and overcome and make that change they want to change. And then the third type is the person that has repeated that cycle so many times over and over and over again that they've finally just given up on setting resolutions altogether. The number threes often look at the number ones with a mix of envy and disdain. I wish I had their willpower. They're so perfect. Why can't I be more like them? Don't worry, my threes. Our ones experience all kinds of challenges of their own. They may be invisible to the rest of us while we're watching them efficiently check off their to-do lists, but they're in there somewhere. It's just a part of being human. We are all perfectly imperfect creatures. We have inherent worth and dignity, but let's face it, we do not always live up to our own best intentions. And there should be no shame in that. Life, especially when one is blessed with the power and burden of free will, can be hard. The more time I spend in UU communities, the more I come to believe that we are all doing the very best that we can. In these very trying times, what I hope for you, my friends, is peace. You are enough. You are doing enough. And if at any time you're feeling like you are not doing enough, that is probably where your lesson is waiting. Turn towards that feeling. Welcome it in. Invite it to sit for a spell. Sometimes, if we allow ourselves to sit with that inner critic with a pen and paper in hand, we may come to find when and where that voice originally came to live within us. We can do this with any thought or unconscious behavior that we are willing to examine. Do you find yourself becoming uncharacteristically angry when someone doesn't go when you're running late and the light turns green? Or maybe your thing is you procrastinate on important work of value that you seriously want to get done, but just can't seem to get started. Or maybe you spend so much time organizing your space that you never actually have any time left over to get out and venture outside of your space. Doesn't matter what it is. If there is something that you want to do more of or less of, than your conscious mind says it wishes it was doing, then it's quite likely that you've got an unconscious helper trying to help you achieve something else that it thinks is more important than whatever that thing is that you are trying unsuccessfully to do or not do more of or less of. Whatever is unconscious is running the show. I'll say that again because I think it bears repeating. Whatever is unconscious is running the show. Social psychologist Jonathan Haidt developed a metaphor of an elephant, the rider, and the path to help explain this reality. The rider is our conscious, rational, analytical mind, the one that makes the plans and the New Year's resolutions. It can think, and it can surely use its reins to direct the elephant one way or the other as it works to get from point A to point B. Now, often enough, the elephant goes where it's directed, except when it doesn't, because it's an elephant. And although it can be directed, if the rider wants to go left and the elephant wants to go right, you can pretty much guarantee that both the elephant and that rider are going to go right every single time. All of those times when we say we want one thing, but we actually end up doing the exact opposite, it is very likely that our unconscious elephant has a very different idea about which direction is in our best interest. Now, since we're talking metaphorically here, it's important to know that this inner elephant can take on a limitless number of characters, each of whom is intent on going its own direction in its own way, which is not the same way that you, our hapless rider, would like to go. Maybe your unconscious is more like a thoroughbred horse or a wild horse. He's all full of energy and high anxiety, pushing the gate, ready to run in whatever direction seems easiest once the gates are thrown open, eager to buck and throw her jockey off. Maybe your unconscious is more like a jackrabbit, eagerly bounding this way and that, never in anything resembling a straight line, never able to be pinned down, never wanting to stop and rest for too long for fear of all the things that rabbits fear. I heard one person that was exploring this unconscious spirit animal describe this part of their mind as a butterfly on LSD, flittering this way and that and back again with seemingly no rhyme or reason. And while none of these creatures can be fully trained, they can surely become better known. And it is through knowing these creatures and beginning to understand why they have taken up residence in our brains and why they behave in the ways that they do, that they can begin to loosen their influence on our conscious day-to-day decisions. But it's never through force or willpower. The more we try to direct the elephant or the horse or the rabbit with force and demands, the less control we seem to have over them. In fact, not only do these creatures go off in whatever direction they want, they disappear. These metaphorical creatures in our heads are actually very fearful of being controlled. As soon as they sense the rider or the jockey or the farmer, off they go. Because like all creatures, their main goal is survival. And here's where the problem comes in. Each of these subconscious creatures, the elephant that goes left when you want it to go right, the horse that is racked with anxiety in the gate, the jackrabbit or the butterfly that flitters this way and that, avoiding the thing that it is looking for. Each of these creatures came into being when we were children. Before we had our Ivy League degrees, before we had our diplomas from the adult school of hard knocks, before our riders were old enough to make their own conscious decisions about how we want to spend our hours and our days, these creatures showed up in our minds to try to protect us. They appeared to protect us from the overbearing parent whose anger appeared whenever our house was in disarray, from the bully that was waiting for us while we walked to school, from the caregiver who only seemed to pay attention to us when we were in crisis. All of these actors played a role in the formation of the little zoos in our subconscious minds, each animal appearing with a behavior designed to keep our childhood selves safe in situations that felt scary or confusing or uncomfortable. So here today, whether it's 9 days after you've set a resolution you haven't been able to stick with, or if it's a change you've been wrestling with unsuccessfully for the past 50 years, I'm inviting you to consider a different approach. Rather than the Western way of trying to bend the will of your nature to your desires through brute force, I invite you to consider an alternative, a softer approach, a more relational approach. I remember one lesson so vividly from my meditation retreat with Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh. When offering guidance on how to control our racing minds as we attempted to meditate and remain focused on our breath, he said, "Embrace the thoughts that keep demanding your attention, and embrace them with the tenderness you would hold a child with. Let them know it's safe. Be curious. Ask it what it's come here to share with you, and then accept its gift and send it on its way." I've done a good bit of spiritual development over the past many years, and I've found that the most effective teachers I've worked with have always used some version of this same approach. Quiet the mind, welcome whatever appears, help it to feel safe, and just be curious about all the lessons it might be willing to share. I remember at one point, during an especially stressful stretch, it became clear that I had fully ceded control of my efforts to my unconscious protectors. I had an important deadline drawing near that had a lot of influence over my future, I believed. I was dealing with one stressful trauma after another. I had nothing left in the tank. And my elephant was very, very intently making sure I did everything possible that I might do except the very important and somewhat scary thing I needed to do. I pushed and I pushed, and the harder I tried to push, the further and further away I got from the thing I was trying to move towards. Until I finally gave up. Trying to force myself to do the thing I so clearly wanted and felt like I needed to do was just not working. So I stopped and I sat and I just tried to implement the lessons I'd been taught. Breathe in, breathe out, repeat. And I kept sitting and I kept breathing in and I kept breathing out. All the while that this was happening, the clock was ticking towards my very important deadline. And I sat and I breathed. And then it happened. A flash, an insight, a memory. I jotted down a few words. A story began to emerge. Not long after this moment, it was time to meet with my spiritual director. When I relayed this story to her, her praise was swift. She said, "You have done one of the easiest and most difficult things in the entire world. Many over the centuries have referred to this as the great turning. In the face of an overwhelming challenge, you turn to look inside for the solution." And sure enough, as we began to unpack the story that I had jotted down, my understanding of the behaviors that were pulling me away from my intended path began to come into clear focus. I began to understand just where these behaviors had come from and what purpose they had evolved to serve, and how clearly their protections were no longer needed in my life. How their attempts at protection had actually become at cross purposes with my well-being. At which point, I was able to thank them for their service and invite them so tenderly to head out to pasture and retire because they had served me so valiantly for so long. Now, of course, I share this story in the form of a paragraph when this process can sometimes take a little bit longer. Because as my teacher shared, the process is mind-numbingly simple. Sit quietly. Turn towards the source of your angst, welcome it, sit with it, embrace it, gently explore it, be curious about the lessons that it has to offer, and never, ever try to overpower it. Sounds easy, right? Of course it's easy. It's as easy as bending the will of an elephant or a wild stallion. And while the steps are simple, and the process is not all that difficult, anyone that has tried to meditate or anybody that has gone down this path can assess it takes a tremendous amount of courage and patience. Wild animals very rarely choose to be tamed. And the more traumatic the events that cause these protectors to rush to our rescue, the more timid and hard to pin down these elephants can be. There are many ways to do this work. Alone, with a pen and paper, with the help of a therapist or a spiritual director, or finally with the help of a friend or two, or 10. One of the purposes of a religious community such as this is to provide support for each of us on our spiritual journeys. Because my elephant isn't your elephant, sometimes it's easier to see another person's elephant than it is to see our own. And if we have developed a safe enough pasture of mutual trust, sometimes another can help us better notice our own elephants and can work with us to help coax them out of hiding where they can perhaps be guided a bit more intentionally. I sometimes think a big part of my job as a minister is to help a community continue on the path of becoming a safe enough space to hold not only our brightest lights, but also our darkest shadows. This is the ultimate gift of the beloved community. The world is hard enough. We don't need to make it harder than it has to be. This week, and for the rest of this year. As you continue to try to bring your highest intentions to life, I invite you to focus not on your stated intentions, whatever they may be, but rather on the headwinds that seem intent to push you off course. Because just like the wind, our unconscious protectors can be very hard to see, but they can be caught. All it takes is a little bit of quiet and a tender, patient embrace. Let us resolve this year in our own hearts and within this community to make peace with our shadows. Because we know that this world needs our light more than ever, and we can't afford to have our fires squashed by overzealous elephants, no matter how well-intentioned they may be. Blessed be, and may it be so.
Thank you, Reverend Matt. Now we have time for discussion.
I read something about traditions of the native, some of the native folks of this land that acknowledged like intentionally and clearly and publicly acknowledged that each of us, no matter how wonderful and good and kind and caring and generous we are, also are imbued with all of those, what you call evil, what you call, what some call shadows, which some call intentions that we wish weren't there. And our culture tends to try to hide those and attach shame to them and say, well, you're good, but you should have shame about these things. And so we hide them and they go underground and they can become cancerous. And what this writing that I was reading said was basically that these are all, when these things are all acknowledged as part of who we naturally are as humans in a community, they can be looked at. They are more likely to be shared. They are less likely to go underground and have the embers turn into a fire that overtakes us. And we also can be more restorative in our justice efforts, because we are not saying, well, I am this perfect being and this person has done this thing or not done this thing, which is evil. We can look at it and say, we are all imperfect creatures. You have done this thing. And the ultimate point of this this writing was to say that was the thing that kept people from being sent out of the community, because they knew that we are all imperfect, but we all need each other. And so let's come and be honest with each other about what our challenges are and what our strengths are, and accept all. So again, not always easy to do depending on the depth of the darkness, but that was the I think the most important thing to think about meditation is the point of meditation is not to meditate. It's not to sit on the cushion. The point of meditation is to get to know your mind and to practice being with it, and to practice noticing when it's pulling you one way, even though you think you want to go the other way. It's simply a practice of noticing. And it is in the noticing that we can then begin to have a little bit more control, because we are aware of the elephant or whatever it is that's trying to pull us in another direction. It's an intention of bringing that unconscious forward and being able to interact with it more directly. Brené Brown does a lot of work on shame in our society and the sources of it, and that's a lot of it. It's this culturally created sense that we have to be perfect, and anything less than perfect needs to be hidden. It's not who we are. And of course, the Marvel superheroes are all archetypes that, whose sources can be found in ancient Greek mythology and et cetera like that. And it's all the same stuff, right? We all get about, somewhere between, some number of decades, hopefully, if we're lucky, to try to figure out what's going on here. And we keep coming to the same answers. And sometimes it just takes us a longer time to learn the lessons, even though all the signposts are have been seen.